Hello and welcome to Andrew's Answers, Life's Questions Answered. I am Dr. Rusty Andrews with Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas. And we're here today to talk about life's questions, how life is lived, and relationships, and answer your questions. You can send us questions at any time by sending an email to answers, that's A-N-S-W-E-R-S, at andrewsinc, A-N-D-R-E-W-S-I-N-C.net. So send your questions via email to answers at andrewsinc.net. We won't use your name, or rather we'll change your name before we answer your question. Please let me mention to you that we want you to remember that when we talk about answers to life's questions, all statements are intended to be helpful in a general way, and answers are of a general nature. They are not intended to take the place of personal counseling or input from a mental health professional with whom you would work directly. You can also follow us on Twitter, at Rusty Andrews, and you can check us out at the Konza Internet Radio website. That's Konza Radio, K-O-N-Z-A-R-A-D-I-O, konzaradio.org. But be sure and send us your questions. You can send it right now or anytime you think of one to answers at andrewsinc.net, and we will answer questions here on Andrew's Answers. Today we have with us a special guest, Dr. John Fagin, who is also a clinician at Andrews and Associates in Manhattan, Kansas. Welcome, Dr. Fagin.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Rusty.
Well, we're going to have a good time today, although we're going to talk about an issue that is kind of troubling and is one that is a very much a hot button for us in our society, as it should be and would be in virtually any society, and that's the issue of sex abuse and also the issue of sexual perpetrators. That is something that is, you know, with all the laws that we have against sex crimes, that is still a rampant activity, a bad behavior that happens in many, many segments of our society, and it's not just limited to one group of people. So can you just say a little bit from your perspective about the effects of sex abuse and maybe some of where that kind of behavior comes from? And let's get into this topic, even though it's one that's maybe not a lot of fun to talk about. But I think the more we talk about it, the better we are at understanding it. Maybe the better we are at actually helping avoid the problem in as many cases as possible.
Well, when I was an undergraduate in the early 70s, childhood sexual abuse was never mentioned. Mm-hmm. When I was in graduate school in the late 70s, we had a professor who had been in child protective services in Denver as a worker on the street. Mm-hmm. And she went back to graduate school and became mm-hmm. a professor at Oklahoma State University. And when she got there and started talking about what's really going on in the real world, we mm-hmm. were appalled. Mm-hmm. We thought, well, maybe in the ghettos of New York City or Los Angeles, but not in good old Denver, Colorado. Mm-hmm. But then the facts started coming out. And at first, the statistics indicated that perhaps 1 out of 100 girls was sexually abused by age 18. And then other studies were maybe 1 out of 10. And then finally, it came down to 1 out of 3. And that statistic has remained pretty stable. There was just this huge denial that this could possibly occur in typical families. Mm-hmm. And so it was swept under the rug. Professionals simply didn't believe children mm-hmm. when they tried to disclose. They thought perhaps it was the child's imagination or a mm-hmm. dream or mm-hmm. a wishful thinking. Mm-hmm. Freud had some interesting ideas about sexual interests of children and their parents. And mm-hmm. so that sort of persisted for quite some time. But what it boiled down to when, and I really think this was a function of the women's movements in the 60s and 70s, where mm-hmm. where they became more interested in college and graduate school and professional degrees mm-hmm. and started doing research about other women mm-hmm. and about families in general mm-hmm. to promote safety and success. And so I really attribute this growing interest in that group of professionals. It turns out that sexual abuse occurs in every race, class, religion, culture, and country. Mm-hmm. I don't care if you're the bottom of the heap or if you're the president's daughter. Mm-hmm. The risk is the same, mm-hmm. whether you go to church or not, mm-hmm. Whether you belong to the country club or not. The mm-hmm. risk is the same. It happens everywhere.
So there doesn't seem to be any environmentally protective factors. You can't say, well, if we just got everybody to this socioeconomic level, or if we just got everybody to be more involved in this particular social institution or something like that. That's not, from the statistics that exist right now, that's not the way that that's going to change.
Well, the way you would change it would be to make for healthier families.
Yes.
Healthier marriages, healthier mm-hmm. families in general. Mm-hmm. But just raising incomes or raising employment rates, raising education is not going to do it.
Not going to do it because it's so rampant across all. Yeah. And the statistic of 1 in 3 for girls before the age of 18 being abused sexually. Now, I would assume that that would mean not necessarily within their own immediate family, but by someone.
By someone they should be able to trust.
Yes.
That's the criteria.
Yes.
I believe it does include some date rape statistics, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but...
But still someone that you should be able to trust. This is not somebody who's jumping out from behind a bush on a dark night.
This is not stranger danger.
Yes.
This is someone who's supposedly trusted. 1 out of 6 boys are sexually abused as well, it turns out. But they don't report it nearly mm-hmm. as readily as females might. Mm-hmm. In terms of perpetrators, the worst, statistically, the worst perpetrator is the stepfather.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that a natural father who has been involved in the child's life from the beginning and who's changed dirty diapers is probably not going to be very interested in that to the same degree.
Yeah.
Whereas if a stepfather enters a family and there's a child that's available there, he may consider that more of an object rather than his own mm-hmm. flesh and blood mm-hmm. and may act out mm-hmm. at that point.
Mm-hmm. And certainly what we're talking about here is not something that's universally among step family situations, but we're just talking about what are some of the situations that occur where it is riskier. And again, it comes back to it's not about how much money you make or where you go to church or how smart you are or how much education you've been involved in. It's more about the health of the family. And step families can be very healthy and not have incidences of sex abuse going on. And that's the main thing.
Well, let me clarify. It's sort of a second degree relationship.
Mm-hmm.
The first degree of natural parents is a fairly protective factor. But an uncle, a grandfather, a stepfather, an older brother, or stepbrother, half-brother,
mm-hmm.
that second-degree relationship mm-hmm. gives the perpetrator access to the child, and, mm-hmm. and people tend to trust them,
mm-hmm.
but they are more likely to cross that boundary
mm-hmm.
than a primary mm-hmm. connection, such as a mother or a mm-hmm. father.
And feel a motivation to cross it out of their own desires, out of their whatever is going on inside their own head, as opposed to somebody, as you were mentioning, more of the first-degree kind of relationship. That's not really something that's coming up in their mind. As a matter of fact, there's something called the incest panic, where if someone in a family starts to think or have a fleeting sexual thought about someone in their family, it just sends off all sorts of warning signals in their brain, and oh my gosh, I can't think that way about that person. So that's much more of a natural occurrence, that something about us and families that we have sort of a natural built-in protection from that.
There was some interesting research some years ago in the 90s when this was really, really a hot topic that showed that there are a number of typical adults who can become aroused at watching movies of children in provocative situations
mm-hmm.
or sexually involved in mm-hmm. situations.
Mm-hmm.
They become aroused, but they don't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
And there is the ability, and sometimes that panic at beginning to be interested in a child doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you.
Yeah.
It's only if you act on it or if you obsess about it.
Well,
if it becomes if it becomes too important to you.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, anyone can have a fleeting moment of arousal at seeing someone in their family, but most of us have enough ego, enough self-regulation, enough self-respect and self-esteem to avoid that, to shut it down, walk away, get interested in something else, and not perseverate on that.
So let's talk for or focus on here for a few minutes on the perpetrators of sexual abuse. Are there certain characteristics that do define that person, or other than just the second degree relationship?
Well, let's differentiate between pedophilia and sexual abusers. Okay. The term pedophilia or pedophilia is often tossed about as applying to anyone who has been interested in children or sexually crossed the boundary and offended a child. By definition, a pedophilia, and there are females also, as well as males, but predominantly males, who seem to have an arrested development. They are interested in children primarily as a cohort. They would prefer to socialize with them. There are a number of incipient pedophiles who love to take children to the zoo or to the circus. They love to be camp counselors, or they love to get involved in volunteer organizations where they are around children because they prefer children. They may never cross the line into sexual behavior, but children are their peers, their counterparts, their cohort. So if you... or if a person were in a family and as a second degree relative and crossed that boundary, then they're not a pedophile because they prefer their own peer. The teens prefer teens or the adults prefer adults, but they're opportunists. They take advantage of a situation in an isolated or sometimes repetitive way. But a pedophile, by nature, prefers children in all walks of life. They may marry an adult to have access to children. And typically, they're prepubescent children. Once a child hits puberty, they're not going to be attacked by a pedophile. They want children who look like children. And more often than not, they will choose maybe only white children, may only another race, may only boys, maybe only girls. But they're very, very obsessed with just a very narrow range of child. I've only seen one true pedophile in my whole career. He was sent by the court for an assessment to determine whether he should, whether he could be treated on an outpatient basis or whether he needed to be incarcerated. And they do have significant treatment programs in the prison system at the state level. And he was incredible. He was bright. He was capable. He had a job. He for all the world, everybody in his neighborhood thought he was just a wonderful guy who liked to spend time with children. And he had lots of children's movies, and he would have a dozen kids over to his house, have popcorn and pizza and Pepsi, and they'd all watch movies, and he wouldn't touch a one of them until he'd find just the right one. And then he'd start to court just that one. And having 10 or 15 other kids over there was a great cover because all of them came back to their parents. They came back to their parents with all positive. He never did a thing. He never touched us, never said a word. Yeah, hiding in plain sight. I like that phrase. That's that's exactly what this gentleman would do. But he had such a compulsion. He said, I'm afraid I'm going to do it again. And I said, I'm afraid they'll murder you. The neighbors will get you next time. Because he'd been convicted one time already and released to outpatient counseling. Which was ineffective, unfortunately, because he told the counselor, I didn't do it, I just plea bargained. They found me guilty because I plea bargained, but I really didn't do it. So there was nothing to talk about. So he didn't get better.
And no responsibility personally for him.
So 10 years later, he gets arrested again, and he said, I'm afraid to go home. I'm afraid the neighbors are going to kill me. He said, I'm ready to go to jail. I'll be safer there.
Absolutely. So that brings up the issue of treatment, and is it even possible to treat?
Well, there's some interesting controversy about that. There was a school of thought that said that once someone abuses, they will always abuse, and that it will just get progressive and you can never trust them. Well, that data was gathered from people who were incarcerated. They had been arrested a number of times, been slapped on the wrist or put on probation or sent to counseling, and it repeated until they wound up with a long-term 10 or 20-year sentence. Well, certainly all of those people had repetitive problems.
Their examples are the ones that are not going to respond to treatment.
There is a certain subset of people who are going to do it over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And then the people, typically psychologists, who want to create psychological testing to try to predict who's going mm-hmm. to become a permanent perpetrator, mm-hmm. used data from those people and looked at their childhood and looked for predictors in their childhood that predicted yeah. mm-hmm. that they were there. Mm-hmm. What they didn't look at was teenagers who had been perpetrators mm-hmm. once or twice and never did it again. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure how the folks woke up to it, but... Well, it turned out that the psychological test predicted that every one of them would keep doing it. So they, mm-hmm. the test was worthless.
Yeah.
Well, there was some other research where they took a number of young people who had perpetrated, and they followed them for up to 6 years to see if they committed any other crimes mm-hmm. or were caught again or mm-hmm. if they finished high school and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And they found that only a very small percentage of teenage or child perpetrators went on to become adult perpetrators. Mm-hmm. It turns
very
out,
different findings.
Yes, very yeah. different. Mm-hmm. If a child or a teenager gets involved, doesn't get very far before they get caught. Mm-hmm. They get confronted by the court. Mm-hmm. Maybe they go to counseling or on mm-hmm. probation. Mm-hmm. Most of those learn their lesson mm-hmm. and don't go on. The perpetrators who do go on are readily identified because they do a wide variety of other antisocial acts as children. Mm. They're more of a conduct disorder. Mm-hmm. They're more likely to be dropping out of school, stealing, mm-hmm. Harming other children, torturing animals. Mm-hmm. That sort of antisocial attitude in children mm-hmm. that is just the starting of the sexual process. Mm-hmm. But there are lots of just poorly equipped kids who do make sexual advances to smaller children out of curiosity or loneliness, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. who, as soon as they're busted mm-hmm. and given other options, never, ever consider mm-hmm. it again.
So you're really talking about a range of perpetrators here, and unfortunately the law sort of is you're either in the group of perpetrators or you're out of the group.
It's very unfortunate. I do certainly support the public posting on the FBI website of, mm-hmm. of sexual perpetrators, mm-hmm. but they damage more people than they help, I think, because mm-hmm. those people, like a 16-year-old who has a Romeo and Juliet relationship with a 14-year-old, mm-hmm. it's consensual, it's illegal.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But they are painted with the same brush as someone who rapes.
Mm-hmm.
Forcibly, painfully rapes.
Yeah.
And that's ridiculous.
Or even examples, and this has ones that I've been aware of an 18-year-old who's got a 17-year-old girlfriend.
Well, in Kansas, that's perfectly legal. 16 is the age of consent in Kansas unless you're a biological relative of the first degree. You have to be 18 to have sex with your father in Kansas legally.
Which is not funny, but I understand.
It does catch people off guard.
It's a bizarre state of affairs.
Well, the idea,
because it's so difficult to define. I mean, the goal should be who's going to become a problem that we can't do anything to help except just put them away.
Well, keep in mind that child sexual abuse is more about power, just like rape. It's more about power than
it's not
it is
about sex.
Sex, mm-hmm. not that much. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is if an 18-year-old girl chooses that, she's an adult and it's not a power differential to the same degree as a 16-year-old girl mm-hmm. or a 15-year-old girl. Mm-hmm. So that's the way the law in the state of Kansas was written several years ago. I don't know if it's been changed, but of course it wasn't that long ago. A 14-year-old boy and a 12-year-old girl could consent to a common law marriage.
In Kansas. Yeah.
That law's been changed too.
Yeah, I think there didn't somebody come down from Nebraska to make that happen?
But, I'm not sure.
Yeah. Okay. We want to talk a little bit more about this, but I want us to take a break and take a little breather here, and we'll come back and talk a little bit more about childhood sexual abuse and perhaps maybe appropriate responses by family members to reports of that. Get a little bit more clarification on this very, very difficult topic, but one that's very appropriate for us to take a look at, I think. So you're listening to Andrews Answers. I'm Dr. Rusty Andrews. You can send us an email at answers@andrewsinc.net. This is Andrew's Answers, Life's Questions Answered on Konza Internet Radio.
Sound a little strange to you and me. But to his 2-year-old son, who's interested in cars and colors, he makes perfect sense.
That's the sound cars make.
When you talk with your child, you build vocabulary, and learning starts long before school does. So follow their lead. Take simple everyday moments, like eating dinner or just watching cars go by, and turn them into learning moments.
Ooh, look, Luca!
Yes, that's moving awfully fast.
Luca!
Yes! The man in the red car is about to meet the man in the blue car. Get himself a pretty pink ticket.
Turn everyday moments into learning moments. For more tips, go to bornlearning.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
And welcome back to Andrew's Answers, Life's Questions Answered, right here on Konza Internet Radio. I'm Dr. Rusty Andrews with Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas, and we are talking this morning with Dr. John Fagin, also of Andrews & Associates. We're talking about the difficult yet, I believe, necessary topic of sexual abuse and sex perpetrators, and trying to get a little better definition than perhaps exists in the law of what it means to be a perpetrator. As well, frankly, of being an abuse victim. And one of the things, the issues that I think comes up is how, or is it possible, and if so, how does one predict who might be have a penchant for becoming a perpetrator? Are there things that you can look for?
I suppose that there are situations where an adult might stumble into a sexual encounter with a child or teenager out of loneliness, crisis, death, divorce, may just sort of get seduced into it, not to blame the victim, but seduced by the situation.
In their own minds, yes.
And then be terribly remorseful, terribly frightened of consequences, and never even consider doing it again. The ones that you're more concerned about are the ones who seem to have a preoccupation or an obsession mm-hmm. with sexual misbehavior. There's a certain subset of adults who are interested, and I don't believe that pornography leads to rape or sexual abuse, mm-hmm. but it's a parallel.
Okay,
it's an obsession with alternative sexual outlets or topics, mm-hmm. and so the ones that you worry about the most are the ones who have been overly interested in sexuality in general. Ones that use force or threat. Mm-hmm. If you tell anyone, I'll kill you. Mm-hmm. If you tell anyone, I'll drown your kitten. Mm-hmm. If they've committed other crimes that show an impulse control problem mm-hmm. or an unusual obsession, mm-hmm. If they have any tendency towards being a sociopath, meaning that they make their own rules without concern for others.
So what I do to you, I don't even think about what it does to you. It's only what value I get from it.
Those are the ones, like we talked about with the children in the first part of the show, if there's a generalized sort of lack of empathy for other people, mm-hmm. sort of I make my own rules mm-hmm. just for the fun of it, mm-hmm. as a child or as an adult, mm-hmm. you're probably going to see a repetition of all kinds of crimes, and this is just part of the picture.
One of them, yeah.
And as I was saying a moment ago, that's entirely different than somebody who stumbles into a sexual encounter mm-hmm. in an emotional crisis in their own life, and then self-regulates after that. The impact on the victim may be somewhat similar, but you know, there's people sexually abused for different reasons. There's no psychological profile of a psychological test. When people are referred by the court for a sexual abuse perpetrator evaluation, and the court wants to know, shall we put them in treatment, put them on probation, put them in, put them in prison? You know, what I'm looking for is an overall picture of their morality, their self-regulation. What are they interested in? What's their social support system? If they have made a mistake, and it's against the law, and it's a terrible thing, but if it's isolated, they're probably going to stay in the community. If they have a host of other problems, even if this is the only sexual contact they've had, if they have a host of problems that show a lack of empathy, a lack of concern for social values, probably going to go away.
And need to.
And need to, absolutely. Because they will likely repeat. Because they just don't have that sense of belonging to the community and being a contributor. They're like a predator or a lone wolf who takes what he or she wants. And that's predictable from childhood in terms of that tendency to make mistakes versus to be antisocial beginning at age eight.
And those kinds of things, those indicators, are those issues you were talking about, like cruelty, not even necessarily to people. And parallels between that and what is often termed as bullying behavior, or behavior that would lead one to think that you might become a bully as later on in life. I mean, it's that kind of behavior.
I just remembered something. I was cruising the internet this morning, just kind of prepping for this, and I found that among incarcerated pedophiles, men who preferred relationships with children, not just sexually, but preferred them. 99 out of 100 of them were obsessed with Star Trek.
Really?
Yeah. I found that just fascinating.
But not all Star Trek obsessed people are.
No. It goes one way, but not necessarily the other. Thing. But they seem to be obsessed with living in an imaginary world.
The fantasy. Yeah.
And kind of creating the future and creating reality and living with creatures that aren't real, you know, flying in a spaceship with aliens or different life forms. And it's almost like that's what the pedophile does. They live in an alternative world of their own creation.
I would say fascinating.
And they're not hurting the child. they're teaching the child. They're nurturing.
In their mind.
Loving. And in fact, they are very nice to their victims. There is a subset of pedophiles, though, that you see on CSI who then murder them quite, you know. But most pedophiles are very gentle and very sweet and very loving. And they leave the child with a profound sense of guilt and shame rather than trauma. Because the relationship ends, and then down the road, the child begins to wonder, why? What happened? Why am I abandoned? Or why did I allow that to happen? What did I do to cause that to happen? But most pedophiles and their victims don't involve any violence of any kind. It's a very sweet love affair. It's very often seemingly reciprocal. The child loves the adult. And a pedophile will choose its victims based on neglect by the parents. There's a loneliness. There's an absent parent. Maybe it's a single parent. Maybe it's low income. Maybe
they become a vulnerable target.
Absolutely. And here comes this prince in shining armor who buys them toys, who takes them to the zoo, who gives them presents, who gives them compliments. They will do anything that guy asks them to do. The majority of pedophiles are males, but there are a significant number of females who prefer small children. One of the other things that came up in research some time ago was that among adolescent perpetrators, only 75% of them are males. 25% of adolescent sexual perpetrators are females. They constitute maybe 1% to 2% of people who are ever arrested or incarcerated compared to males because no one will believe that a female will sexually abuse a small child. But, in fact, it does happen very frequently, and I have had adult female clients who, in the middle of psychotherapy, burst out in tears and said, I have to tell you something. It's the awfulest secret in the whole world. I can't live with myself. And confessed that they had, in fact, cross that boundary. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then we're able to work it through and understand why that happened at that particular time mm-hmm. in their life, and they never mm-hmm. did it again. Mm-hmm. And they come to terms with it, and they make peace with themselves finally after mm-hmm. 20 or 30 years of guilt and shame mm-hmm. and or maybe completely suppressing the secret, and then it pops up unannounced after they see a movie or have a bad mm-hmm. dream. Mm-hmm. And but our culture just won't attribute misbehavior to females for some reason. They tend to see males as bad and females mm-hmm. as good. And so mm-hmm. even if a child said that the babysitter did this or the babysitter did that, it oftentimes doesn't get reported. And I hope my son doesn't mind. One of my four sons, disclosed that he was sexually abused by a babysitter. Mm-hmm. He considered getting lucky.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
he yeah. didn't consider it abuse.
No.
But it was.
Which is that social, part of it is a social stigma. Well, I'm a boy. I shouldn't be, nothing bad would have happened to me. I must have let it happen. So then you think of it as, well, yeah, something happened that I liked.
And who knows, yeah. you know, we can't look at what didn't happen. So uh-huh. who knows how he may have ended up differently as an adult, mm-hmm. for better or for worse, mm-hmm. if that teenage babysitter hadn't lured him into some misbehavior.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't tell us for years and years, and, you know, yeah. we didn't notice any symptoms mm-hmm. at that time in his life. But, mm-hmm. you know, it certainly could affect the formation of personality.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It could make that child be obsessed about wanting to repeat the situation.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
Or if things didn't work quite right, if the plumbing didn't work so good when you're mm-hmm. 10 years old, mm-hmm. you might feel inadequate for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
all sorts of consequences that might come out of that for the victim. And talking about dealing with and helping, being supportive of people who are victims of childhood sexual abuse, we could spend a whole hour talking about that, and perhaps we ought to sometime, because that is with 1 in 3 females and 1 in 6 males being sexually abused at some level when they are children, then you've got an awful lot of people who are dealing with the consequences of that, and most of whom have never said anything to anyone about it, or never said anything to someone in authority about what's happened to them.
My clinical experience has taught me that if a mother is sexually abused as a child and tells someone, she protects her children.
Mm-hmm.
If a mother, when she was a child, was sexually abused and kept the secret, mm-hmm. her children are much more likely to be sexually abused.
Mm-hmm.
She's so busy denying what happened to her, mm-hmm. she can't see what's happening right in front of her.
Mm-hmm.
And if she was victimized as a child, she's very likely to choose a somewhat disordered man for a partner mm-hmm. because she doesn't feel good enough to pick the captain of the football team or the president mm-hmm. of the junior class.
Mm-hmm.
And so she feels damaged and inadequate and worthless. And so she settles for someone who may not be a good partner
mm-hmm.
and then, or stepfather or whatever. And then she can't see that there's an obsession with her own child mm-hmm. and that child. Very often when a woman comes in and says, yes, I was sexually abused, the adults, mm-hmm. I mean, go ask your mother. Don't ask her if she was sexually abused. Ask her how old she was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because if you ask them, were you, they're more likely to say no.
Mm-hmm.
But if you sneak around the mulberry bush and just ask them how old they were, they oftentimes answer the question.
Mm-hmm.
And then their mother will say, but I never told anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And telling and being believed and being protected has a tremendous curative process and a protective process for future generations. Secrets are the worst thing you can mm-hmm. have.
And it strikes me that in my work with adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse, that their anger, their hurt, the pain that they experience is much more associated with the fact that they were not believed or cared for or protected by their parent than anything that was done to them, sometimes even over a period of years, by the perpetrator.
Sometimes mother disbelieving the child and let's face it, there are a lot in our culture, unfortunately, incomes are not equal. And mm-hmm. In the past, females were not encouraged to complete university and get good careers. They were encouraged to be wives and mothers. And so a lot of times they can't support the kids without the perpetrator there.
Mm-hmm.
So they have denied. I mean, I think we saw it more in the generation that we have as adults now than we are occurring now. But a lot of times they just told the daughter, this didn't happen, you're lying, and punished the child mm-hmm. for disclosing because they had to have the perpetrator's income to keep the rest of the children fed.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, the lack of protection by the mother is oftentimes far more painful than what happened.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, I don't think, you know, when you watch nature flicks and you see the hyenas attack a herd of zebras, they always mm-hmm. pick off the weakest one,
yes.
the one that mom wasn't watching.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's kind of the way it is with humans as well. The perpetrator picks the one who doesn't have a good relationship with mom.
Mm-hmm.
If mom is close to her kids, you're only going to abuse that kid once, and then she's going to scratch your eyes out.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if she, because of depression or because of some preoccupation with something else, if she's not close to her daughter, you can mm-hmm. pick that child a number of times.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes just the failure of the bond between the mother and the child, which is 18 years long,
mm-hmm.
is actually far more dangerous or damaging than Uncle Bob or Grandpa Bill getting you in a corner a couple of weekends a year.
And we should point out that we're not talking about rightness or wrongness about these things right now. We're just talking about how it looks to the kid who is the victim, that's consistently client after client turns out to be the thing that bothers them the most.
The victims that I have treated as adults, the ones who had the hardest time recovering were the ones who were abused very sweetly.
Mm-hmm.
Very early in life,
mm-hmm.
where they were alienated from mom, and the perpetrator then filled the spot of a nurturing person
mm-hmm.
and then gradually made it a sexual process.
Mm-hmm.
The child then is very interested. I mean, children are very sexual people.
Mm-hmm.
They will stimulate themselves, and mm-hmm. they will allow other children to stimulate mm-hmm. them, and it tickles, and I'm sure it must feel mm-hmm. good. And there's not a natural taboo for a child to resist that.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you seduce a child carefully,
mm-hmm.
pre-kindergarten mm-hmm. and about that age, they will have a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. And they don't know anything different.
They don't know what's wrong.
You've created this aberrant world for them, and that's the world they live in.
Absolutely. Then they go to school, or they go to church, or they go to Girl Scouts, and discover this isn't happening to other
mm-hmm.
girls.
Mm-hmm.
And then they say, what's wrong with me?
Mm-hmm.
And then they say, but I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. So I'm the crazy one.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the ones who hate themselves. Mm-hmm. They can't hate the perpetrator.
Mm-hmm.
They hate themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the ones who tend to have difficulty maintaining their own personality stability.
Mm-hmm.
They have difficulty with harming themselves
mm-hmm.
because of that guilt and shame.
Mm-hmm.
It's not somebody offended me. It's mm-hmm. I am defective.
Yes. And they do internalize the guilt over what happened. And have Absolutely. A very hard time assigning 100% of the guilt to that adult who knew what they were doing compared to this 5-year-old little girl who had no clue that this was something that was even inappropriate.
Perhaps. Well, 3-year-olds are naturally the center of the universe. They think everything revolves around them,
sure.
for better or for worse. If something goes wrong, it's their fault. If something mm-hmm. goes right, it's look what I did.
Yeah.
And so if you are working sexually, if you're working on a little child at 3 years old, 4 years old, of course, it's natural for them to blame themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And later on, when they're 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, if they start to object, well, you wanted this. Look how long you've enjoyed it. Why quit now?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It seems to me that one of the best things that a parent can do if their child says to them, this has happened to me, is to be supportive of them, to believe them, to protect them. Those kinds of things are going to be the things that help the child then grow through this situation and become a reasonably well-functioning adult. Because it isn't a death sentence emotionally to have had these kinds of things happen to you. There are ripple effects through much of your adulthood, so I'm not trying to minimize it, but parents can help kids who've been victims in a great way by being supportive and believing of them.
I have known a number of adult females, professionally or personally, who have said, yes, I was sexually abused, but my mother believed me and she protected me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe I got a few sessions of counseling or not, mm-hmm. but, you know, I was able to keep my self-esteem and mm-hmm. understand it was not my fault. Mm-hmm. And then it's not a problem.
Yeah.
Being sexually abused, like you said perfectly well, is not a life sentence.
Mm-hmm.
You can, a child certainly can recover from that. But, you know, even if mom has some doubts or dad has some doubts when they're mm-hmm. first disclosed, they should act as if they believe mm-hmm. until they can get it investigated mm-hmm. by professionals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not mom and dad's decision to decide who's innocent and who's guilty.
Mm-hmm.
There are, you know, SRS has trained professionals, the police has trained professionals mm-hmm. who interview. And they there's always that question of, well, I think somebody coached this child to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not hard to pick out a child who's been coached.
Yeah.
Because they have a scenario that they have to repeat verbatim, and they mm-hmm. can't deviate from it, mm-hmm. and that sort of mm-hmm. thing. They can't improvise on it,
mm-hmm.
and so it's not hard to pick out a child who's been coached,
mm-hmm.
and so there are very, very few situations. One of the things that the court runs into a lot, I've discovered in during divorce and custody proceedings, mm-hmm. is right in the middle of a custody evaluation, mm-hmm. somebody gets accused of sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when it comes up then, judges tend to be very leery of believing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when it comes up in a neutral setting, so to speak, when there's no crisis in the family, I mean, it's possible a child will disclose in a crisis, so it could be true.
Mm-hmm.
But very often, people actually make this stuff up mm-hmm. to gain
adults
advantage.
That make
yes,
it
yes,
up.
Yes,
yeah.
Of course. Children don't make this stuff up.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever had a child who said this
mm-hmm.
when it wasn't true. Mm-hmm. Except one case in Wichita many, many years ago where this somewhat disabled child was encouraged to say this and was given, if you do this, then this good thing will happen mm-hmm. and you'll be able to live with this parent and so mm-hmm. and so and so.
Mm-hmm.
And so the child dutifully reported, mm-hmm. this is what happened.
But then it becomes fairly obvious that they've been coached to say that.
So it fell apart.
Then that's not really their report.
No. Yeah. She just wasn't sophisticated enough to carry the story through mm-hmm. challenges.
Mm-hmm.
It was just sort of a rote repetition, and it didn't hold water.
Mm-hmm.
And finally we just asked her, who told you to say this?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, it was so-and-so.
And the story fell apart then, so. Well, it is a difficult issue to think about and talk about, and we really have been thinking about it more from the angle of talking about the perpetrators during this program. And we do need to spend some time at some point talking about how people can very much deal with issues of childhood sexual abuse and deal with the sequelae of that, the things that come after that, and be perfectly healthy, happy, emotionally well-adjusted adults. You had a story there about sometimes abusers do not fit any kind of profile.
I think the most difficult, I've not worked personally or professionally with any of these perpetrators, it's the school teachers,
mm-hmm.
the female school teachers mm-hmm. who get into these love affairs with middle school, high school boys,
mm-hmm.
that's something I've not wrapped my head around.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't mm-hmm. get it.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that if I were to take some classes on it, I would you know, become mm-hmm. capable of understanding and working with those people. But that's the one that I have the most trouble with.
Mm-hmm.
That and religious leaders who mm-hmm. molest little boys. That. Mm-hmm. Those two groups, you know, when you're in a profession,
yes,
where you are there to teach and nurture and rescue, mm-hmm. and then you use your position
mm-hmm.
to hurt children, you know, I can kind of understand families, step families, mm-hmm. second, third degree relatives, mm-hmm. neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
I can sort of work with those people.
At least kind of get what's going on.
But when a professional does it,
mm-hmm.
I don't get it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I haven't figured that out yet.
And the fact that you're in that profession means you were placed there in a position of trust by other adults. And so you do have a responsibility to be above reproach in your behaviors with those charges that you are given by their parents, by their families. Well, we're going to take a break and come back and answer some questions that have nothing to do with this. So we'll be off of the topic. But if you have questions that you want to ask, please email those to us. And they can be about anything about life and relationships. We'd love to have your questions. We will change the name so nobody can identify you. But you can email those to answers@AndrewsInc. That's AndrewsInc.net. And you are listening to Andrew's Answers, Life's Questions Answered on Konza Internet Radio.
Janine Marks, a 12-year-old, was fairly normal. She spent a lot of time online. One day, she met a new friend. The new friend had the same problems at home. They liked the same bands. They worried about the same subjects in school. They promised to keep each other's secrets. They wished they went to the same junior high. The new friend had good news. He said he was going to be in Janine's area one Saturday. He thought it would be amazing if they could just hang out, go to the mall. Janine agreed. The new friend didn't want parents messing this up. Janine showed up alone. So did her new friend, who wasn't in junior high, wasn't nice, and wasn't a 14-year-old boy. Every day, children are sexually solicited online. Help delete online predators. Call 1-800-THE-LOST or visit cybertipline.com to learn how to protect your kids' online life. A message from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and the Ad Council.
Attention parents of young children.
The following is a partial list of things that are probably happening in your backseat
that you are completely unaware of.
A food item is probably being stuffed into a crack.
A strange sticky substance is being spread everywhere.
Deep, sustained nasal exploration.
Someone is probably making faces.
Hitting back.
The cleaning of muddy shoes.
Something is probably spilling.
Gum is lodging in hair.
And your kids are probably riding car seats that are being used incorrectly. In fact, 3 out of 4 kids are not as safe as they should be. But the latch system is in most cars and makes it easier to get it right.
Just attach the top tether and the lower anchors.
The ones down near the old sandwich and the melted-down crayons.
Anchor, tether, latch. The next generation of child safety.
A message from the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Ad Council.
And welcome back to Andrews Answers, Life's Questions Answered. I'm Dr. Rusty Andrews, here along with Dr. John Fagin, both of us from Andrews and Associates Counseling in Manhattan, Kansas. We've been talking about sexual abuse. And we're going to get off of that topic and talk about some more generalized things that have been questions that have been answered. But here's a at least in the world of dealing with sexuality. And as you said, sex abuse and sex perpetrators, it's really not about sex any more than rape is truly about sex. It's more about a power differential, but more into the world of sexual behaviors. We have Ginger who writes in asking about her teenage son who she found surfing the internet and involved in watching pornography, which is so available today compared to the way it was 30 or 40 years ago. What kind of advice do you have to give to a mom that she just doesn't know what to do? And dealing, or whether it's even something she should be dealing with.
Well, that's an excellent question that I can't answer.
Okay,
it's just a brief history. Back the first time I was ever exposed to any real pornography was in the '60s in the military, and one of the other guys had some slides that were very, very explicit. That was long before Playboy was getting that explicit. And he showed them to me, and I thought, well, that was interesting. And then, of course, there were always novels and books as well as magazines. And then, of course, along comes the VCR, mm-hmm. in the 80s and the early 90s, and you could rent movies mm-hmm. from the wine list in the back room, mm-hmm. Or so I've heard. Yeah. And and then came along DVDs, and you could copy them, and you could, you know, have a variety mm-hmm. of them, and mm-hmm. they were easy to store and hide from your kids and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then along comes the internet in the mid to late 90s, and you can now go online and look at any amount of pornography you want for absolutely free. Mm-hmm. You don't have to prove you're 18. You don't have to have a credit card or pay for it. And I know this because of what people tell me. Mm-hmm. You know, in doing marriage counseling and family counseling, I get a lot of complaints from women because their spouses go online mm-hmm. and look at porn. And it turns out that people actually do this more at work than they do at home. Mm-hmm. And approximately 20% of those people who cruise the porn sites are females at work. It's because between the hours of 9 to 5, mm-hmm. and the rest are males. Mm-hmm. I'm not
so that's
sure.
a fairly substantial number, and maybe a surprising number for
surprising
some folks
number.
that one out of five porn surfers are female.
Females tend to be more interested in books, mm-hmm. those steamy romance novels mm-hmm. at the grocery store checkout that are extremely explicit. Mm-hmm. But females tend to prefer to read about it. Mm-hmm. And when they cruise porn sites during working hours, they tend to go to chat rooms mm-hmm. where they're interacting with other people in more of a romantic way with a mm-hmm. sexual overtone. Mm-hmm. Guys just like to look at it. Mm-hmm. They like to watch. Mm-hmm. And the grosser the better, I think, from what
visual
I've heard.
Visual stimulation.
Men seem to be more visual. Mm-hmm. And women have a different orientation. But a lot of women consider their partner cheating on them. You know, truly it's mm-hmm. it's an infidelity because mm-hmm. he's looking at her instead of him looking at me. Mm-hmm. And maybe, mm-hmm. you know, it's kind of your morality. It's kind of the way you were brought up to believe mm-hmm. what's okay and what's not okay. Mm-hmm. Some families might say, well, you can look, but you can't touch. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like going to the beach and seeing things. You know, what are you supposed to do? Close your eyes? Mm-hmm. You know, it's there.
So it's where you draw the line, and that really is a very, very idiosyncratic thing. And it's
the other part of it is that it's secret, and I think that's what's frightening. When
yes.
you don't know how far that person is going mm-hmm. or how
does
obsessed
this mean
they
something
are.
Else?
Yes, yeah. yes. But the really worst part about it is that kids have found, you know, you hear about sexting where they take pictures of themselves mm-hmm. and send to each other. Kids are going online and looking at hardcore porn. Mm-hmm. They'll get up in the middle of the night, log on to mom and dad's computer, or mom goes out to pick up the other kids from school, and teenage mm-hmm. boy gets on her laptop and mm-hmm. cruises mm-hmm. and has 20 minutes a day, every day, to go wherever his heart leads him. The reason I say I can't answer that is there's no clear research that I have found that says that looking at porn leads to anything else. Mm-hmm. There's a correlation. A mm-hmm. lot of people who look at porn also do other inappropriate mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. But to say A leads to B mm-hmm. is not necessarily statistically effective. Mm-hmm. A and B may be driven by some C.
Yes.
And so, you know, every kid who smokes weed started out drinking milk. Does that mean drinking milk leads you into smoking
yeah.
weed
yeah.
later on? No,
yeah.
no. It's a, mm-hmm. it's a one-way correlation, but not a two-way correlation. Mm-hmm. And so we don't know yet what when teenagers start having this preoccupation and fascination or compulsion mm-hmm. with looking at porn. We don't know because it's so recent that they've had this much access that we don't know if it's going to hurt them or help them.
There are no teenagers who had lots of internet porn access that are now 40 years old and for us to ask the question.
We have no history in yeah. the life space to say, kids who watch this porn now are doing this or they're mm-hmm. not doing that. We don't know.
Yeah.
I think we should discourage it in every possible way, and I think that the businesses that run these sites should have some way of filtering them mm-hmm. or parents should take a much more aggressive style of putting blocks on their own computers mm-hmm. and not just their kids' computers. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure how that works technically, but I know it's possible.
And not very difficult.
I really don't know. Yeah. I'm not an IT person. But it can't be good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some, you know, kids need some awareness of sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
They need to know that it's okay for adults to do this and that.
Mm-hmm.
And I developed a personal theory in the course of working with thousands of families. If kids are aware that their parents have a love affair and a sexual relationship,
mm-hmm.
but it's not an overexposure,
mm-hmm.
then they seem to be content to wait till they're adults and they're married,
mm-hmm.
because married people have fun.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's forbidden, if it's shut down, if it's absolute in total secrecy, then children get the idea, I better have as much fun as I can before I get married, because it goes away after I get married. And uh-huh. so parents have an obligation, I think, to have some degree of exposure to their children of appropriate contact mm-hmm. within a family setting mm-hmm. that says it's okay for us to be alone in our bedroom at 8 o'clock at night with the door
mm-hmm.
locked.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't need to know what we're doing, but you can use your imagination.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to having an ice cube cold relationship until mm-hmm. the kids are all in bed, and then, you know, what happens
yeah.
behind closed doors
yeah.
is okay. So,
but you are talking about reasonable, appropriate adult sexual activity. And the unfortunate thing that happens with teenage kids is that they're exposed to stuff that might not really fit that category quite so much. And their ideas of what good sex between a man and a woman as adults are just being developed, as opposed to they've developed them, now they see this and, oh, that's interesting, as you mentioned, you know, well, that's kind of interesting, but it's not seen through the same kind of eyes when you're 15 years old.
Yes.
And that's an issue.
Some of the interesting stories that kids tell me is that they know what dad's doing at 2 o'clock in the morning when he's the only one up and watching
mm-hmm.
TV. So they sneak out of bed and sneak down the hall and peer around the corner
mm-hmm.
and wind up watching the same movie as dad.
Yeah.
That's not good.
Yeah, no, that's the, and again, they don't have any way of processing that in a way that dad has got to process that. So,
and you know, there's a difference in childhood curiosity about sex and typical childhood behavior. Like
mm-hmm.
before kindergarten,
yeah.
kids are very interested
yeah.
in sexuality
uh-huh.
and they tend to play doctor and that
mm-hmm.
sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there are certain things that kids would never consider doing
mm-hmm.
unless they've been exposed
yes.
to pornography.
Yes.
And so if they're doing like oral genital things or anal things,
mm-hmm.
they've been exposed. They've
mm-hmm.
been abused indirectly in one way or another, or directly.
Yeah.
But the kids who just touch each other or just playing doctor, just curious, they probably
general
are doing
curiosity.
All right. Probably
yeah.
doing all right.
Yeah.
You just set limits and say, we don't do that,
mm-hmm.
you know, or you only do that alone in your room.
Mm-hmm.
But the kids who go too far have been exposed to porn.
Yeah. And the thing you mentioned earlier about understanding that, you know, that married adults have sex, I don't know that there's any porn out there that's husband and wife together. It's mostly
well. You'd be the expert
else.
About that. I wouldn't know anything about that.
but I asked the students in my general psychology class I teach who statistically has the most sex, and they don't know the answer. And the answer is the statistical group that has the most sex is married couples with each other. I mean, with their husband or wife.
Over 60 years of marriage, I hope so.
Yeah. So the ones that have the most, that consistently have the most sex is them. And then I ask them, which of you is the last child out of the house? And those that raise their hand, I say, well, do you know what your parents are doing right now? So,
that's
so, so to understand sexuality from a healthy, it's fun, it's
right.
a good thing. It has a very good place in appropriate relationships, is a great thing, and actually can be an encouragement to kids. Pornography tends to distort that view, and that is why it becomes an issue, particularly with children. So, well, thanks very much for the question, and we invite your questions to answers@andrewsinc.net. You can follow us on Twitter @RustyAndrews, and you can check us out on the Konza Internet Radio website at Konza Radio, that's KONZA radio.org. I want to thank Dr. John Fagin of Andrews & Associates for being with us today. I am Dr. Rusty Andrews, and this is Andrews Answers Life's Questions Answered on Kanza Internet Radio.
Listening to Kanza Internet Radio at www.kanzaradio.org. We would like to thank the Lawrence, Kansas musical group Mammoth Life for the music used during the previous programming.